Here it is, a Monday, November 16th, and it is another episode of Let There Be Talk, episode number 564. Thanks for tuning in today, and also thanks for tuning in to my brand new podcast, The Grail. All of you out there that went and listened to that episode with Grover Jackson, The Grail is my second podcast now, and it is available on iTunes, YouTube, SoundCloud, all over the place. And it's a dedicated show for all of the great artisans. I fucking hate that word, artisans. You know what is that? It's dedicated to fucking people that work with their hands, work outside the box, build stuff, paint stuff, design stuff. You know what I mean? Those kind of people. Anyway, so that is available now on iTunes. Subscribe to it, leave a review, and also check out my patreon.com/DeanDelRay for 93 bonus episodes and all kinds of fun Zoom Fest stuff. Every weekend I Zoom with all the Patreoners. All right, got that out of the way. Let's get into a little bit of the weekend. How was your weekend? My weekend was a little off. I think over the pandemic 8 months, I've gone up and down, but this weekend with all of the who won the fucking election and are we going into another lockdown? Is there going to be no stand-up comedy? All of that shit fucking hit me around Saturday morning like a punch in the face. And I just sat there like, what the fuck? People are moving. Everybody's angry and crazy. And it just hit me like, God damn, man. What the fuck happened, you know? And then I put on some music. And I just kind of sat there and thought about things and thought about how lucky I am to have this podcast and you guys listening and to interview dream guests like over the last 9 years, not just the last few weeks of AC/DC and Rob Halford. And that's over the last 9 years, this show is kind of I've been a dream. It's really all I want to do is kind of podcast and do stand-up comedy. I've finally found what I love to do after all these years, and I'm lucky to be able to do one of them. And who knows when stand-up will come. I am supposed to do some shows in the first week of December in Texas with Bill Burr. So hopefully we'll get to do those. Who knows? It's a shit show out there. People don't wear their masks. People wear masks. People say masks don't work. People say the fucking pandemic's fake, doesn't exist. People say that's not my president. This guy's my president. It's just fucking a boiler. A boiler. I can't imagine living my life every day that angry. I really, really cannot imagine just waking up fucking furious over other human beings' sexuality or their races or their religion. I just cannot imagine being that fucking person. So I put on the music and I just enjoyed the weekend and did a little hiking, got some air in my system. My ankle's fucked up, so I haven't been able to exercise as much as I do. I exercise every day, and I think that's one of the things. If I don't exercise, my brain starts to go into dark places. So if you're there, get out there and exercise. Even if you're one of those fucking couch potatoes, you got to get out there, man, and get that blood moving and keep your thoughts positive. With that being said, I am happy to bring you today's guest, another incredible singer that I've got to finally talk to. Mr. Angry Anderson of Rose Tattoo. One of the greatest cult bands ever out of Australia. A lot of you would know them by Guns N' Roses covering their song Nice Boys. And a lot of you might know them because you're a music freak like myself. But if you don't know them, you are in for a great ride of fresh new rock and roll to your ears. And I recommend before you listen to this episode, go and stream wherever the hell you stream and listen to some Rose Tattoo. Go check out their videos on YouTube. Understand this man and his powerful voice, and then come back and listen to the episode. It may be so good that you forget to listen to the episode, and I'm fine with that because that's how great this band is. And due to the fucking COVID-19, their first tour of America since 1983 has been postponed, which is just fucking crazy bummer. A lot of good talk here. A lot of talk about the early days of that pub rock sound in Australia that AC/DC and Rose Tattoo and the Choir Boys came out of. And a lot of great talk about his technique. A lot of great talk about his acting career and his politics and his thoughts on the world. And I absolutely enjoyed talking to this man, and I can't wait to have him on again already. So let's get ready for that. Before I do, I did mention the Patreon. I want to welcome some new Patreoners here. Scott Butler, welcome. Captain Knass, Captain Knass. I'm never going to get that name. Captain Knass. Nate Banditelli. I think I nailed that one. And the king of the Patreoners this week is Nicholas Orfenides. Welcome to the Patreon, people. Thank you. Also, I want to tell you guys, I am selling a shirt and hoodie. You can check my Instagram for the design, and you can DM me on how to pre-order one. Makes a great little holiday gift for your friends, your Dale Razors. Excellent shirt. Before I do go, I want to tell you, Joey Diaz is going to be on Ozzy's Boneyard, I think twice a month for now on, doing a couple hours of music, and I want to congratulate him on that. And it's kicking off November 25th, 26th, and 27th. You can catch him on Ozzy's Boneyard spinning his favorite tunes and telling some stories. And I'm so happy for Joey. He's out there in Jersey, living his life, enjoying it with his new podcast, Joey's Joint. And I love that man. All right. Don't forget, the new podcast comes out every Wednesday, The Grail. And here we go right now. Let's get into this one with the legend himself, the king of the throat singers, Angry Anderson of Rose Tattoo. Candles lit.
You listen to your music at home, you go, no. Why would I listen to my music? I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's a difficult thing to explain, but and it's the same with, by way of explanation, it's the same with the artwork. I mean, I very seldom see the artwork, and it's very nostalgic.
Oh, it's a beautiful album cover. And we go back to the old world, of course, of album covers, and you see it. If you're in a record store and you're a 12, 13 year old kid, you grab that and you go, whoa, what's this? Snakes. There's some rockers on the stage and you're in, you bought it.
Yeah, really. Now that's a very, very, that's a very, very astute observation. But, when we did the cover, I remember the art department, you know, because Albert's was very, very innovative label in many ways. And one of the things, of course, one of the great things about it was that they produced so many iconic Australian rock and roll bands.
Of course.
Because of their approach to recording, the genius of George and Harry as far as arrangers went. And producers, and they weren't scared of loud guitar bands. And I remember years and years and years ago when I was, because I was born and raised in Melbourne, and I remember going to I think pretty much it was Festival Hall, which was an old boxing hall that was built, you know, in the 30s or 40s when boxing was huge in Australia. And that's what it was known for, was its boxing history. But of course, as the 50s arrived, it became a rock and roll venue because it was big enough to hold big crowds. And I remember going to see the Easy Beats in the very, very early days. And, you know, like they were for their time.
George's band.
Yeah, George and Harry. And they were very loud band for their day. In fact, they were quite loud, and which was one of the most exciting things about them, because one of the first things that I learned about being loud as far as a band goes is that, you know, it's a very, very exciting sensory experience to be involved in. That's what Volume's about. That's why concerts have become and equipment's become louder and louder and louder and louder. I mean, obviously in the arena sense, you need the volume to carry, you know, like back. It's like when we do Wacken, you know, there's 30,000, 35,000 people in front of the stage, in a corral, so to speak. You know, they're fenced in. So, you know, they need to hear. They need to hear, the kids at the back need to hear as much as the kids at the front. So you have these amazing, gigantic systems these days. But in those days, getting back to the Easy Beats, they had column PAs. And instead of having two columns a side, which was 8-12s, and that's what they used to play through in those days, because usually the only thing that went through the PA was the vocals. There might have been a couple of mics over the kit for spill, but predominantly you didn't mic everything in those days. Everything was sort of stage sound. Yeah. Anyway, pardon me. We got a bit distracted. Back to the logo. Yes, it is iconic, and Pete, obviously aspiring tattoo artist at the time, as well as being a you know, the slide player, but and the founder of the band, he came up with that as a logo, because it's a tattoo design, as you can see.
Absolutely.
Which is, I think, is why it's some and the first logo that we had was one big single rose, with a snake entwined behind the rose, which was a very, very iconic tattoo in its day. In fact, I had one very similar, which is, you know, before I'd even met Pete, I got a rose and snake on my arm, which is now covered over because it was a pretty dodgy piece of work.
Well, it's there's that famous, you know, flash stuff of that Sailor Jerry stuff where you go into a tattoo shop and you just be like, oh, wow, look at this. And if you were in the Navy, you'd be like, give me number 34. And then you got a tattoo, you know, but of course, as we went along, because, you know, Bon Scott was the first guy I saw personally that had tattoos that was in a band. I was like, whoa, what is that? But as we got older and you start seeing these beautiful sleeves coming out, like you have, I have sleeves too. Tattooing became a totally different art, and even now it's like way out there, man.
Well, I saw some work because Tony and I are going to finally, after all these years, going to finish my back piece, and I'm a bit apprehensive because The line work on my buttocks is, you know, quite painful, but I'm not looking forward to the colouring in aspect of it, because that's, you know, obviously there's large areas of colour, which is going to be very punishing. But yeah, I remember actually someone told me, and I stand guilty of not actually having read the book, but I do have a copy of Tommy Lee's book, and someone told me that he said, maybe in the book, but certainly said in an interview, that once they had seen the tats, and Pete and I had sleeves, and that's when him and Nikki went out and I have a standing invitation from the LA tattoo shop, Los Angeles tattoo shop, where they got their sleeves to go and get work done. So I was looking forward to the now defunct tour, our first tour of America since 83 was the last time we were there.
God, so long ago.
Yeah, and I was going to go to the shop and get something on my legs, you know, to take up the offer, because, you know, I love free ink. It's like, because yeah. Ink's become very, very, as you know, like with the popularity, et cetera, ink's become very, very expensive.
It's crazy, right? Remember when I first started getting, and you're older than me, you're 73, I'm 54. But I remember I have all these, I would get tattooed by a famous guy named Henry Goldfield, one of the San Francisco legends. And he would write up this kind of really cool receipt. He had these receipts that were artwork, and it'd say snake, $125, you know?
Yeah, really.
For a full arm snake all the way down my arm, you know?
Or
dragon and skull, 75. You know, you can't even get in the chair now for under.
Cost you $75 to make an appointment.
It does. It does.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, first of all, I absolutely love your voice. I've sang all my life, and I'm a comedian now, but I grew up on, you know, the dirty rock and roll. I love that type of singing. And, you know, you, Bon Scott, these type of voices,
it's a throat thing.
Yeah, it really is, right?
Yeah, the energy comes from, obviously, from your chest, your lungs, obviously. But when you're taught to sing, they teach you to, the sound starts here. Whereas throat singers, like rock singers, like blues belters, which is, that's what we are.
Yeah.
We're just, you know, we're just, I mean, the Rosie Tats are like AC/DC, just a very loud blues band. And, I remember actually having conversations with Bon about our style of vocal delivery, if you like, or the way that we sing. You know, I've always been pleased, you know, like people like Alex Harvey, that Bon turned me on to.
That guy's great.
Paul Rogers, even though he's obviously had a lot of, because he had the brilliance of the raw talent, but over the years I feel he's, with his techniques, etc., that he's had coaching, and he's had which is it's always a plus to have, you know, breathing coaching, etc., and delivery, which I'm just too lazy to get involved in. But I remember running into Angus for the first time in 30 years plus a couple of years ago, when he just finished a run with Axl and Guns N' Roses were out here, and Angus must have been visiting family. So he, you know, whenever we do supports for Guns N' Roses, they always ask me to hang around for fucking hours, to get up and sing Nice Boys, see. And but Angus came along that time to play a couple of tunes with them, a couple of AC/DC songs. And so Angus and I were able to catch up after all those years, you know, of not being, you know, I mean, we obviously, you know, don't move in the same circles musically anymore. So there's no reason why our paths would cross. But, you know, we were talking about, and I remember saying to, and I got a lot of time for Axel, and I thought he was very much an obvious choice. And I said to Angus, I said, you know, was it hard picking someone? He goes, well, yeah, no. He said, like, someone has to handle the range for a start, like be able to hit this so they don't have to change the keys of the songs.
Right.
You know, they had to get someone who could hit in another style of singing the same notes as Brian. And I said, did you ever consider Sammy Hagar? And he just sort of looked at me and he went, fuck, Sammy Hagar. I said, well, mate, he's a fucking monster, you know. But he's not a throat singer. He's, you know, I mean, obviously we all use our throat.
Right.
But my sound, the sound of my voice, starts from down here, diaphragm, obviously lung power. But when it gets to here, that's when it becomes a sound, you know.
The shape, you like, shape it in there.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, I purposely, when I was very young, like 16, 17, I was trying to sing like Bill Brunsey and you know, Lightning Hopkins, and you know, the classic blues singers, Howling Wolf, and they all had this, which was very like, I didn't understand that. I mean, I knew that they were black guys, blues, you know, because by that time. Because when I first started listening to the blues, it was just all sound. As my uncle, you know, he put me onto music in the first place. He's a drummer in a swing band, and I was like 4 or 5 years old, and I was listening to these amazing singers and amazing music. And, you know, as a four, five, six-year-old, I'm not thinking about, well, who am I listening to, or, you know, just what, you know, these great singers, white and black. And I didn't differentiate for a long time between, you know, whether they were white or whether they were black. But then I started to, as I got older, I was starting to see the photographs of the singer on the album sleeve. And I'm going like, wow, you know, like he's a black guy.
Yeah, you don't know what anybody looks like back then. Even pre-MTV, you had to buy a magazine. Sometimes the covers didn't have any of the band members on it. It would just be artwork. You didn't know what they wore, who they were, or anything until you bought a ticket to the show. The mystique was pretty amazing, right?
I remember the first time. Well, I don't remember the first time, but I remember, in a sense, the experience. Because most of my, until I found the blues, which was, and I was a bit older, in the early days, I was listening to swing bands because my uncle, who turned me onto music, was a drummer in a swing band, and he also was a great singer. But a lot of the big band swing, you know, had their people out the front, like, you know, Doris Day and lots of female singers, and then came along, you know, the Frank Sinatras, the very, very young Frank Sinatras, and the sort of guys that Tony Bennett, et cetera, that sang in front of bands.
The crooners.
That's how they got their start. And, I remember actually what I was going to say, illustrating very vividly how I never cared about, you know, whether what I was listening to, a black or a white person, it was the sound of their voice, the way they sang. I was, you know, total romantic that I am. I fell in love with this person regardless of gender or color or whatever. And I remember it was some years later, and I was in the record shop, and I was there was an album on, and I thought, fuck me, that's amazing. It was Odetta. And so I went to the guy and I said, what's this album? And he said, oh, you know, it's Odetta. And I said, how much is it? And he said, oh, you know, like 8 shillings and or whatever. And Actually, you should have got a laugh out of your 8 shillings. That was pre-decimal. pound shillings and pence, right? So
right.
The old English system. So I said, yeah. So I saved like mad because I was selling papers in those days. I was a paper boy. So I saved like mad and rushed back to the shop. I said, you know, I want this. I thought Odette, anyway, the point I'm making, I thought Odette was male because she got this beautiful, big, you know, beautiful, beautiful voice. Like, Jesus, like I still love listening to her records because of the timbre of her voice. It's such a fantastic voice. And I'm so, you know, I get the cover, you know, and in those days there were those really thick cardboard covers. And I flipped it over and there was a photo, a black and white photo of her, and it was a woman. And I went, fuck, it's a woman, you know. But I, because of her voice, you know, I thought she was a bloke. Not that I cared one way or the other.
I think that your type of singing and Bon and these other guys later on, I do a tribute to Bon once a year. And when I sing it, I think you either have that or you don't. That's all there is to it. You can't just do that kind of throat kind of singing if you don't have it, especially if you're trained and you're like a Freddie Mercury type of guy or whatever. You just can't do it.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that differentiates, you know, like when you say Freddie Mercury, and that's a perfect example because great singer, but very operatic in so much as his projection and the style, that was a purposeful thing. But I think probably that he always had that natural ability. He just built on it. That's what singers do. They find out, well, what am I best at? Very, very early in the piece. You know, that's why when I remember with the early Beatles records, it was John's voice that I loved the most because it had that it reeked. You know, my favourite singer of all time is Rod Stewart. So
oh, fantastic.
There again. See, like, and it's worth mentioning as I digress, as you'll pick up that I do often. I think one of the great vocal performances that I've seen in recent years was, I got it on CD somewhere. DVD or whatever, you know, the disc, is Paul Rodgers singing in front of Queen, which everyone thought, like, fuck, is that going to work? You know, but it did, and it worked amazingly, you know, because Paul's not a loud singer, but he's got great control over, you know, over his delivery. And he knows that as a singer, you don't have to sing loud. You just have to sound loud.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. That, you know, Frankie Miller, he was the king.
Yeah.
That guy was a singer, man. I mean, you know, and you mentioned Rod Stewart, of course, in, you know, The Faces when he's doing like Flying. Those are some classic blues rock singers.
Yeah.
I mean, those sounds, Frankie Miller, that sound, you know, and those are just great, great, great singers. But
Joe Cocker.
Oh, my God. You know, feeling really. All right. That shit is unreal, right?
Yeah. Classic stuff and never been done better by anybody. And there was a guy, I remember doing a TV show in Melbourne called Countdown. And it was a TV music show, pop show. And I was called in. I don't know why, but I can't remember why. But I was they wanted me to co-compare a couple of segments with Joe Cocker. And, you know, of course, I leapt at the chance because, you know, being such a huge fan since Woodstock. And anyway, we got chat backstage, like when we're waiting for camera setups and stuff, whatever, you know, and he was trying to reform as I was, in those days because we were both hopeless drunks. And anyway, we got chatting about that and a lot of other things. But, you know, we talked about the blues and we talked about – and he said – I said, you know, I'm a huge fan, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he said, yeah. He said, well, you know – and he had a – he's got a – well, had, God rest his soul this very broad Northern English accent, you know, which was difficult to understand at the best of times. But, yeah, he said to me, someone gave me an album of yours, possibly the first album.
Yeah.
Just so I knew that, you know, who I was meeting. He said, man, I fucking love your voice. And coming from him, I just thought that was just the best thing I'd ever heard. And he said, man, I, you know, the band is like, I've never heard anything like it. He said, it's like such a fucking heavy blues band. And plus the fact that, and still to this day, there aren't too many bands that play in the style of Rosie Tats that have slide as the lead instrument.
Right, right.
I mean, you know, bands like Little Feat, which is one of my favorite bands of all time.
Definitely not a lot of bands that had slide as the main thing.
No. And I that was one of the things that that Joe Cocker said. He said, I love, because he loves slide. Well, he did. He loved slide guitar. And but I don't think there's too many people that are into the blues that don't love slide. Well, that's how I fell in love. And again, going back to, but, you know, you listen to those early, a lot of the early blues stuff, and they, you know, because my favorite, of course, is the Godfather, John Lee Hooker.
Oh, yeah.
And, but they would play slide even to punctuate, and they would play the rhythm parts, you know, with their fingers.
Yeah, I love that.
And have the bottleneck, which in those days it really was a bottleneck.
Yeah,
have that on a finger that wasn't being used for the to play the bass lines or the rhythm lines, but but you only got the and that was the slide, and I just thought, like, before I even knew what slide was, I thought, I fucking, whatever that is, I don't care what it is, I want that, you know. I just, you know, and I remember going to a Melbourne blues club many, many years ago. I was still in my teens, obviously, and seeing a guy play, and he had a National Dobro steel, and first time you ever see a completely chrome guitar.
Beautiful.
Is a moment in your life you're not going to forget. And he played picking style, but he had plectrums on three of his fingers.
Oh, yeah.
So he used his little finger as a dull note, but that was a – he played that, and so it had a slightly different sound to it. But his picking fingers
– his finger his picking thumb, it, huh?
Yeah, yeah. So his thumb and his two of his fingers had picks on them. And I went up to him after the show, and I just thought, so I said, almost in fucking tears. And I said, oh, I can't fucking believe that. I said, here, you're playing John Lee Hooker. I mean, no one knows in Australia. He goes, oh man, you know, and he started to talk to me about music. And the fact that I had a collection of albums that, like, only him and his sort of circle had, you know, because they were blues players. And so in the very early 60s, the blues hadn't become, in its authentic format, hadn't really become mainstream yet. And it was because of the Stones and other bands that played the blues that then blues, you know, like it did, or whatever, they revived blues music all around the world, you know, because even the Beatles, to a certain degree, you know, some of the stuff they played was traditional, you know, Matchbox and Lordy Miss Claudie and, you know, those kind of things. So they were all classic blues songs. Yeah. I saw this thing just the other day on Facefast, the original recording of Hey Joe.
Wow.
It was a white guy.
Wow. Yeah. No idea.
Yeah. And it was like this really grainy, you know, and the guitar, it looked like a cord that you used to use to switch lights on or pull your blinds. It was like, but it went across his shoulder and to the top of the neck instead of, so it was, you know, before they started anchoring the guitar strap onto the body.
Right.
They used to anchor it to the neck.
Oh, man.
To the top, you know, where the nut, where the head joins the neck. And, there was this recording. I remember the first time I ever heard Hey Joe, I went and saw Eric Burdon's band at Festival Hall in Melbourne. And I just love Eric Burdon. I think he's just one of the great blues singers, white blues singers of all time. And went and saw him with his band, not the Animals.
Right.
The Eric Burdon band, the War band, you know.
Love it.
Was a great band. And towards the end, anyway, they came out to do some encore songs. He said, "We're going to play a song." He said, "I've just made a new friend back in England." And he said, "You're going to hear a lot about this guy because he's the most amazing guitar player, singer that I've ever seen." And he's an American guy, but he's living in England now, and we've become very good friends. And then they played Hey Joe. And so I heard Eric Burdon's band play Hey Joe before I heard Hendrix.
Wow.
And then when, of course, some months later, everything that was Hendrix was being played, you know, by that time, right, because this is like fucking genius. And you hear those opening notes of fucking Hey Joe, and again, a life-changing moment.
What was that early era like of the, say, the pub rock scene of you guys and AC/DC and that sound? Were there quite a few bands sounding like that? Was it kind of a full scene, like, say, the late 60s, Summer of Love of San Fran, or say a grunge scene later? Was this a scene of this sound?
It was, in so much as I've been asked over the years, about where did I think, you know, for books that have been written. There was even a TV show done about the Alberts label, the Alberts family stroke label, because George and Harry carefully selected the bands that were on Alberts, and that's the only reason we got a deal, because we were introduced to them by largely Bon, but then again, Phil had a lot to do with it too, because Phil had played drums in Buster Brown.
Right.
And then when Buster broke up, he went and joined AC/DC. So we were still friends, right? And Mark was playing bass in those days, and come full circle, he's playing bass in the Tats now,
right?
But Marky Evans, yeah. The godfather of so to speak, of the Australian pub rock guitar sound, which all the heavy rock bands adopted. And still to this day, try and emulate. Airborne is a perfect example. It started with a guy called Lobby Lloyd, who actually ended up in the late 70s playing bass in Rose Tattoo when the band went three-piece with a singer. Well, it was a four-piece band, but three-piece musicians. And I wanted to get Lobby because he's a guitar player and a monstrous, monstrous rock and roll player with a magic, he did. He's passed on, God rest his soul. But he understood the rhythmic, the right hand, you know, the Gene Vincent, Eddie Cochran sort of era, which is fundamental if you're going to play rock and roll. You can play heavy rock or you can play rock, but to play rock and roll, it's got to swing.
Absolutely.
It has to have that syncopation in the drums, but it has to have it in the guitar players too. because it's purely a rhythm thing. You know, it's jive. You know, doop dap doop 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 bap bap boop doop dap. And you understand that. And Lobby, it was in the first time I saw him, he was, you know, I think he was in his probably early 20s. And it played so loud in those bands. In those days, because you have to understand that they all played combos, you know, like with A12 or 212s.
Yeah, small amps, yeah.
Yeah, really. Sitting on chairs or whatever. And Lobby was so fucking loud, even in those days. So we're talking about the early 60s, that he had to have his amp facing the other way. Otherwise, he
turned that amp around.
Yeah, otherwise he drowned everybody else. And he's a legend in Australia for being the loudest guitar player ever in the world. But he because that sound you're talking about, we're talking about, is about the chord thing. Because I mean, the magic of the Tats, the magic of AC/DC, definitely. The Choir Boys, which is another Albert's discovery. It's the, you know, like, you know, it's the chords first, and all those bands very much understood that the rhythm section is everyone except the singer. But when it comes to solos, you've got to have a solo player, right? So, but rock and roll is about rhythm. And the solos became a feature later on in the business. But in the early days, the solos were like this long. Now they're fucking, you know, they overlap each side of the page. But, yeah, so it was one of those things. Lobby, when I asked about, well, where do you think that the Australian pub rock sound, which went to the world and is still now very much an indelible stamp of Australia. I remember Slash once said to me, he said, like, fuck, man. He said, how do you guys get that sound? I said, well, don't ask me. I'm the singer. Ask the fucking guitar player, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mick's reply was, oh, he said, well, you run it just shy of 10 and you just plug your fucking guitar in and, but it's an attitude. You know, it's like anything, and it's a belligerence. And at the Australian identity used to be very belligerent, because it's, you know, it's obviously a hand-me-down from Britain and parts thereafter, you know, from Europe, but predominantly it was, you know, Scottish, Irish, English. And they are, when I say belligerent, they're belligerent in their fortitude, in the way that they approach life, or used to in those days. It's what won wars. It's what helped the English people hold out against insurmountable odds in two world wars and whatever, you know. But it's an attitude, and that attitude manifests itself in the way that Australians play guitar, and you had that magical combination with the Youngs, of course, where they had this heavy Scottish fucking, and I mean, I've never met, you know, a more belligerent person than as a guitar player than Malcolm. I mean, he was, you know, he was like, I didn't look tall. I mean, I, you know, as size wise, one of the things that I had in common, or have in common with the Youngs, is that we're all about the same size. It's just that I was twice as heavy,
yeah,
as them, because they're all skinny little fucks, you know. And
5'2",
No, just fucking. And you know, having met, got to know the family in the old days, they're all like that, you know. They're all, you know, very small, but very Celtic,
yeah.
People, you know, like just the original Celtic people are all quite short, so small, you know. And anyway. Getting back to the guitar thing, Lobby, if you look up Lobby Lloyd's history, and there's a lot of footage and a lot of recordings that he's done, you can hear how he developed over a series of years what became, if you wanted to play rock and roll, that way. And we were all fascinated by his early band. So earliest band was a band called the Purple Hearts. And then he played with another rock and roll legend in this country, Billy Thorpe. Actually, Billy, who's passed on too, he actually credits Lobby with teaching him how to play rock and roll guitar, as opposed to playing guitar as a virtuoso. And Lobby, Billy, if you look up, there's a lot of shit on FaceFast and Google Tube and whatever of the Aztecs, Billy Thorpe and the Aztecs, and it's all, you know, it's all that, you know, bop. We used to call it bop music. Or bumper.
I'm gonna turn on my light here. It's getting dark. Hold on. I'm starting to disappear.
I don't know. I was having one of those. What was that movie? It was a fucking great movie. Yeah, because when you got up, there was parts of you disappeared into the backdrop. So yeah. It's obviously, it's like a screen.
Oh, do you remember that movie? Poltergeist?
Remember that? No. What's that other? It was a fucking, the guy's name, I think it was John. Oh, he made this movie and he got affected somehow, but it was a great movie. It was in the 70s and was it called Altered States?
Altered States, yeah, where they were in the tanks.
And just what's happening now, you held your hand up, right? I can only see your hand and part of your sleeve.
Right.
It looks like it's coming out of the backdrop.
Yeah, right, look, it is.
Do you remember, with his arm? Like, yeah. That was all about the sort of like molecular sort of,
yeah,
that Altered States thing. What was that guy's name? Hurt was his surname.
Oh, William Hurt?
Yeah. He only made a few movies and then he sort of like disappeared. But that movie just struck me. Like, just reminded of it then when you got up because part of you sort of disappeared. I went, whoa, fuck.
Yeah. Speaking of movies, you've done some acting, which is pretty cool.
Back in the day. I wouldn't call it acting.
Yeah. You're on Mad Max Thunderdome.
Yeah.
How is that?
I just played Angry Anderson. I mean, and that it, I remember it was so funny, right? We're doing readings, you know, script readings to sort of like as an audition.
Right.
And Tina hadn't arrived at that stage. So her understudy, if you like, was reading her lines because there was several scenes where Iron Bar is with Auntie, right? So, and with Max. I said to George, you know, because I'm a movie buff, right? I'm like most people. I mean, I love movies.
Yeah.
And good film to me is like, you know, one of the great art forms.
Really is.
But like good literature. But anyway, I remember saying to George, how do you want me to play Iron Bar, right, this character? And he said, pretend you're Angry Anderson. In other words, if I want a fucking actor, I'll get one.
Yeah.
He said, the way I see, you know, because what he meant was how he saw Iron Bar, the reason they picked me was because they wanted that thing, you know.
Yeah.
He said, pretend you're Angry Anderson.
It's so great.
He's a fucking genius too, George.
He really is, man. The series Christ. Of those films are...
There's another one coming.
I know. I just read about that. Those movies are... It's so funny. I always reference them like, man, we're coming to the end here. It's going to be full Road Warrior. We're going to be out there fighting for gasoline or water or something, you know? And I think one day it might be true.
I think soon... There'll come a day, and it could be 50 or it could be 100 years away, it could be 200 years away, where I think there is the possibility that the road warrior will, that lifestyle could come about being, into being.
Pretty wild, man. Pretty wild.
It is, eh? You know, yeah. You think about it, and I think one of the things that I think one of the things that which angers particularly, well, it angers old and young. They've convinced the young through, again, through the manipulation of the press and the propaganda, they've convinced the young that the older generations or the older people don't care. They seem to forget that as a 73-year-old, as you said before, in the 70s, I was marching in the streets with university students, etc., to stop the French testing in the Pacific, the nuclear testing.
Right, right.
We marched in the streets to stop whaling. We were just as revolutionary as they for our time. But I remember my grandfather was in the First World War. You know, he landed in Gallipoli and he went on to fight in Egypt. Two of his sons, which were my biological father's brothers, one was in the Air Force, fought with in the Pacific in the Air Force during the Second World War. And the other one was in the army and went to fight in England because he was for his day, he was a techno wizard. And so he got into radar and because they were working with during the Second World War, and I only found this out years and years later, they were toying around with the concept, if you like, of being able to guide missiles during the Second World War. The Germans certainly were, but so were the British and so were the Americans eventually. But they were sort of looking ahead for the opportunity, not the opportunity, but they knew that historically there would be another great war fought sometime in the future. And they were trying to perfect weaponry to, facilitate victory very easily or a lot more easily. But but I agree. I mean, that's a long-winded answer, isn't it? I mean, I think there's going to be a time when I have a terrible feeling, and I'd hate this to happen. But then again, in 1984, everything that he said was that would come to pass has come to pass. And that's frightening because that was a work of fiction. Some people say, you know, the conspiracy theorists say, well, really, was it? Did he know something? Well, yeah, maybe some people do. You know, there are some people who believe that people can travel in time and they can come back with some or go forward and take knowledge from here or vice versa. I'm not really sure about that one, but certainly Orwell had a vision. Whether he was just a great writer and had this great imagination where he could write amazing stories.
Yeah.
But other people, look at Tolkien. What a fucking imagination that. I nearly said the C word then. I was talking to my son just last couple of days. He's introduced his new girlfriend to Tolkien. And, have you read the Tolkien books?
I haven't.
Fuck me. How that guy, I don't know if opiates were involved or whatever, but how that guy came up with the concept. But see, the books of Tolkien are all about the struggles of the psyche of man with himself and with the world that he lives in. But they are sheer fantasy to the point where it's like, well, having read Tolkien in the 70s, because everyone was reading The Hobbit and then, of course, The Lord of the Rings, I was very interested, like many other movie buffs, when they decided they were going to make Lord of the Rings in New Zealand.
Yeah, yeah.
A New Zealander was going to make – and New Zealand is a very unique – group of islands. It's produced some extraordinary people, and so we all waited with bated breath, as it were. And fuck me if you didn't get it right. He recreated, And the reason that they're, you know, the movies are like 10 hours, well, they're not 10 hours long, but they're 3 hours long and there's the parts, is because it, you can't tell that story any other way. But it, the story is about the triumph of the spirit, the goodness in man, the inherent goodness in all men, the species, all man species. We all know that we need to be free. We all know, and this is inverted commas, we all know that that we are, regardless of what we look like physically, we're all one under the creation. Creation created all of us. So some in Asia evolved that way. Some in Africa evolved that way. Some in Europe evolved that way. But that's just a, it's an exterior thing, you know. It's a, it's like, you know, a species evolving over millions, if like it's hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years, from one thing to another. So it's like animals. I mean, we're not dismayed, if you like, that certain animals evolved a certain way in a certain continent. We go, oh, okay, well, that's fine. I accept that.
Yeah, yeah.
So do we as human beings, but we're all children, if you like, of the creational process. So inherent in all of us is the knowledge. Knowledge comes from feeling. It's what you know. It's instinctive in all of us. So, you know, we've only allowed ourselves to be divided by people who don't want us to remember, stroke, recognize that, you know, we're all brothers and sisters, you know. Like when people say to me, you know, they say, well, why, you know, whenever you perform, and I've always done this purposefully, and now it's just become automatic, but I always refer, when I'm talking to the audience, I always say brothers and sisters, to reinforce in people's psyche that we are brothers and sisters. Anyway, how the fuck did we get onto that one? I think you're manipulating me.
I'm not. I'm just fucking shooting the shit with Angry Anderson on a fucking on a Sunday night in America.
Yeah, Monday morning in Australia.
I always had this question, and I was going to ask Angus last week. I did ask him, actually, but I didn't ask if you were ever considered, or did you ever audition for AC/DC once Bond was gone? No. Considered.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it was an Albert's thing, but and I've thought about it a lot over the years because people have, you know, I mean, it's come up on the odd occasion. It even came up, you know, a couple of years ago when Axel got the job. But at the time, I was in Rose Tattoo, back when Bond passed, and so they were grooming us to be, you know, another international act in a completely different. I mean, you know, people say, oh, you know, Rose Tattoo following in the footsteps of AC/DC, and they all have, you know, the Albert's bands have a similar sound. I mean, we've got certain things in common, one which you alluded to before, which is the guitar thing. But if you really listen to each of those bands, you know, the Angels, AC/DC, Rose Tats, Choir Boys, we've all got our own sound. And that's the one thing that George and Harry looked for was, they didn't want replicas. They didn't want two bands that sounded so similar. They wanted bands that had a certain attitude, who wrote songs a certain way, so that the bands that they produced had something new to offer. So they didn't want copies of AC/DC. They didn't want another copy of the Angels. They didn't want another Rose Tattoo. They wanted something, you know, each band had to stand on its own merit.
And they did. They did. It was, it's a lot like if you look at the grunge scene, there was these bands, Alice in Chains, Nirvana, Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, they are part of a scene, but they all sounded different for sure.
Yeah, it's interesting that you, and I've always found it interesting, that Pearl Jam, it's the same era. But, you know, there's a swag of bands led by Nirvana, as far as when I say led by Nirvana, they became, you know, the grunge heroes. They were the grunge sound, if you like. In Australia, there was a band called Silverchair, and they were sort of our version, if you like.
Remember that song? Hang on, fat boy.
Mate, see, again, I mean, the great thing about the Silverchair was their attitude. You know, they were a bunch of really young kids at the time from Newcastle. And but they had this terrific attitude. And he's a great songwriter. You know, he wrote some fantastic songs, as you just pointed out. I mean, really, really cool songs. And but anyway, getting back to Pearl Jam, the first time I heard Pearl Jam, quite honestly, I don't mean to contradict, but I thought, wow, this is a band that's moving, that's like got this fucking, I mean, you know, Vedder's use of phrasing and melody was as farly, you know, it's different from Nirvana. Like to me, to my ears, I thought, well, this is a band that's resisted. I get that there was a fair bit of grunge in them, like as far as possibly more attitude. But they were more like back in the day, like if you to use examples, back in the day when we were all about this heavy three chord fucking belligerent. There was another powerhouse band came out of Australia, where you'd be aware of the Midnight Oil.
Oh yeah,
but they took a different musical direction altogether. And around about the same time, of course, INXS came, and they were pure pop. So they were getting right into the technico shit, you know, drum machines and keyboard stuff, you know, like Van Halen did. I mean, Van Halen went from being a powerhouse rock trio, and then they all of a sudden their big hits was they got into programming and keyboard sounds and stuff, you know. Like, and I think the band that did it the best, and of course they're my favorite American rock blues band, is ZZ Top, you know. And I mean, when they did the Eliminator stuff, but when we're talking before about guitar players, I think Billy Gibbons is one of the great rock blues players of all time. His choice of notes and phrasing is just fucking amazing. But he's no slouch as a slide player.
No, not at all. Not at all. Yeah,
he's a fucking great slide player. And I remember when we toured with him,
right?
Well, the first time was in the States we did, but that was kind of like we'd already done Europe with them the year previously. And it was their sort of comeback tour in Europe. And so they put us out. We had different opening bands where we went around, and because everyone wanted to be on the tour. And we were really, really lucky that because we were on Atlantic at that stage, and so we got the middle spot, the prime spot.
Yeah,
and that's when Billy and the boys became Tats mates and fans, which is why they've given us so many tours when they've come out here, and we did the States with them. But I remember we were talking guitar players and stuff, and. I remember one night looking across the side of the stage, and we were about 3 or 4 days or a week into the first leg of the tour, Europe, and the three of them were on the side of stage watching, on Pete's side. So later on, we're all backstage and we're having a drink, and And Billy Gibbons said, fuck, man. He said, fucking Peter. He said, I don't know where he said, I'm getting a handle on it, man. Like, you know, like on his approach to slide. Cause Billy's is very traditional, you know, as Pete's, but Pete was Pete, you know, he had another dimension, if you like. And he said, man, he said, Billy said to me, he said, have you ever heard of a guy called Roy Cooter? I said, oh, fuck yeah. You know,
yeah.
Who was, you know, and he said, man, he's my favorite slide player. He said, when you see him play live, he's mesmerizing, which of course he is. He's beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's a very melodic player. You know, I mean, even though he plays blues. See, another great slide player is Bonnie Raitt.
Oh, yeah. Dwayne Allman.
I met Dwayne Allman. Yeah. But you know, beautiful melody. Anyway.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Nice Boys and GNR recording that and stuff. Did that put a blast in your pocket or?
No, not really. It's had nothing to do with them. It came up in conversation, obviously, many years later about what happened. And they used to cover a lot of our songs live. When I say a lot, I mean, you know, half a dozen. They even used to play Butcher at one stage, apparently. Right. But this is when they were very young and they were looking for their own sound and stuff. And anyway, Nice Boys and a couple of other of those songs like Astral Wally and Suicide City suited them, you know, so they used to play them. But so they recorded because Nice Boys became such a favorite in their early set with their audiences. You know, they used to sort of say, oh, you know, this is a song by an Australian band, blah, blah, blah. But that sort of, I suppose, once they started to get very popular, it fell by the wayside. But when they came to do the live album, they included it because it was such a popular live song. Now, the record company, this is according to the boys in the band, the record company went ahead and, as record companies will, they went ahead and just sort of said, well, all songs by Guns N' Roses. So that's how it became known as a Guns N' Roses song. So years later, when it came to Albert's attention that they'd covered a Rose Tat song, but we didn't get a credit, let alone any money. So Albert's contacted the record company and said, look, you know, the boys need credit and they need to be paid. So the record company, I can't even remember what label it was, to tell you the truth.
Geffen.
Geffen, yeah. They came back and said, righto, here's an offer. And Albert's quite rightfully said, well, you know, we don't want an offer to settle. You know, you've got to pay royalties. And they said, well, it's complicated because it's now registered as a Guns N' Roses song. So there'll be a lengthy court case. So we'll see you in court. So I think that's a simplistic version of what happened, because what happened was that Albert's accepted the payout on our behalf. So it's not an ongoing thing.
Right, gotcha.
So I don't know how many I was told years ago by a mate of mine who lives in – well, he's American that album still sells to this day, very, very popular album. So we don't get royalties for them.
Right. But you got your re-records here of the Outlaws record, the 2020 Rose Tattoo record. Mm. So it'll be, you know, I mean, too bad you're not able to tour. I was so fired up. Three nights at the Whiskey. I was ready for this. I've never seen your band. My friend saw you on the cruise ship over the summer, Billy from Jet Boy, said you guys crushed it. Everybody. I mean, you are what, you know, in my biz, they say a comedian's comedian. You guys are a band's band where people are like, oh, we got to go see this. You know, anybody in a band knows. And they said that you destroyed the ship. just killed it. So I was so fired up for these three nights, and I was really looking forward to talking to you in person and seeing you sing in person. I really hope that somehow this happens later down the road, but it could be a long time.
The next cruise was scheduled for February, I think, next year. If the cruise doesn't go ahead, they're going to hold 2 days of festival on island, some islands in the Caribbean somewhere.
Wow.
Yeah, we've already got it. I can't really, you know, I just, my head's been mush for months with everything that's going on in my life at the moment. But, yeah, so the cruise may go ahead. If it doesn't, it's scheduled to go the lineup, which was already booked because, you know, we skipped this year to do next year. And we're still booked, and apparently they still, as long as the restrictions are able to, they're going to honour that, but they're going to put it on over a few days on an island.
Wow. Wow. Mm. That'd be great. I would go to that.
And I think Scotty Crawford, who manages us here, and he's, you know, he manages for America as well. We've only got management in Europe because they were first. They managed us years ago. Thomas Jensen, he's a guy who runs Wacken, which is that's how we met. They took us over there in the early, after the Guns N' Roses shows here in Australia. They realised that we were back, and they were big fans when they were kids. Thomas and his, I think there was an original, I think it was four originals or five originals that started Wacken, and that's a festival to go to. That's fucking amazing. Some of the most amazing bands that I've ever seen. I've seen at Wacken. I saw Slipknot at Wacken.
A great band, right?
Fucking amazing visual. And you know, I a few years ago, well, now not a few years ago, quite a few years ago, ran into Dee Snider.
Oh wow, he's fantastic.
But without, it was just Dee Snider band without all the fucking makeup and shit, and he was fucking I mean,
he's a maniac, huh?
He's great. I love the man.
He is. That guy can sing too, man.
Oh yeah, no, they were fucking amazing. I even liked them in the early days, like with the Twisted Sister shit going on.
Absolutely, absolutely. I got to introduce them at their last show ever about 2 years ago. They did a 4-song set at the Roxy, and I stood about 10 feet from him on stage and watched him sing. From the side, and I couldn't even believe the energy and power coming off that guy. It was like explosive.
Yeah. And he's a big human being too.
Oh, he is.
He's a big lad. One of the others that I was introduced to was another great, we're talking about guitar player sounds, is Ted Nugent. And because I grew up with a whole lot of, you know, with, you know, Farmer. What was his name? Is it Mick Farmer, guitar player? I'm getting closer to my home.
Oh, yeah.
Fucking, there was a bunch of guitar players, and one of them was, of course, you know, Ted Nugent. I'd always wanted to meet Ted Nugent. Anyway, he turned up. Billy said, oh, you know, Ted Nugent's coming tonight and good friends with them. I said, oh, okay. I said, fuck, I'm, you know, just pumped to meet this guy. In fact, I was nervous, you know, to meet this guy. So we get back into the room and the party room. And, there was like 50 or 60 people there right now. So we're myself and I think it was Frank. I was standing with Frank and I said, oh, really? I said, I thought Ted Nugent was coming. I was all G'd up to see him. And he said, he's here, man. You know, and I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, he turns around, there's a bloke standing about 10 feet away, just standing against the wall, right? He had a fringe jacket on, you know, denim jeans, cowboy boots, and a fucking a cap with a badge on it, right? He said, that's him there, man. I said, that's Ted Nugent. He goes, yeah, man. So, and I'd had a few drinks, so I said to Billy, I said, you fucking got to, you know, you got to introduce us. And he said, yeah, okay, come on. So we go over there, and he's quite tall, Ted.
Oh, yeah.
But then again, everyone's tall to me, you know.
Yeah.
So I said, Ted Nugent, I said, man, it's a fucking honor. He said, thank you, man, thank you. And he was a sheriff at the time. He was a county sheriff. He'd run for sheriff and got it where he lives, right? I can't remember where he lives. So that was the badge he had on his cap, yeah. And, yeah, he was just the nicest guy. And I said, can I get you a drink? And he said, man, do you have lemonade or orange juice? And I went, well, yeah, I think we do, you know, because he didn't drink.
Right, right.
Alcohol.
Yeah. That Devil Eye Gonzo record is a masterpiece of 70s rock.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's just, when I watch footage of him now in those days.
Yeah.
Know, it's like fucking, see, now you talk about guitar players. You know, one of the greatest guitar players that ever drew breath is Leslie West.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I did a gig with him.
And he's got that sound.
Yeah. P90, you know? Les Paul Jr., just Mississippi Queen coming at you.
But, you know, I've got all his albums, which is one of the great things about being able to download shit. And I mean, what do they cost you? Like, you know, $3 or something, you know, to fucking, but I've got everything, like, and albums of Leslie West's that I didn't know existed, you know, just him playing blues classics and stuff, you know. I remember when I was still in Melbourne years ago, and the first time Mountain Live came out. And one whole side of the, it's 12 and a half minutes long, it's Nantucket Sleigh Ride. That's live. Now, I have to believe in my heart that that's live. There's no fucking editing, there's no dubs, whatever. And if you, I remember laying there once with the headphones on and just, I got up and I was just crying. I was in tears. And I just thought, I've just heard the most amazing moment of musical history ever. And that live performance is just, it's monumental. Monumental. It's a fucking, I mean, I get the idea that they, you know, mountain, that's a very esoterically potent symbol, a mountain, you know, biblically, we went up the mountain to find God, blah, 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 whatever. And I get the mountain because he was such a big man.
Yeah.
In those early days. But yeah, I had mountain on like about a week or so ago. I was just doing some work here at home. And I've got a pretty big system in my room. And I don't get a chance to really let it breathe. You know, I've got a couple of big old 70s Bose boxes and, you know, they come up to me like they're about a meter tall. They're just full of fucking speakers and tweeters and shit. And, you know, they just drive it with this big fuck off Yamaha concert amp. Can't pick it up. It's so fucking heavy. So I let them have it. Right? I let the neighbors know I'm cleaning house today and you're going to have to fucking listen to Mountain. It was fucking a moment. I was rattling windows a fucking kilometer away. You know, it was fucking really, because yeah, you got to listen to that.
Yeah.
That kind of music, you know. It's like one of my favorite, you know, talking about, because I love talking about classic sounds, but, one great rock and roll album is Humble Pie Live at the Fillmore. I had that on too.
Oh yeah, dude. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
There's like that kind of stuff, you know, like Humble Pie, Cactus. Mm. You get into these kind of culty bands that were just complete 70s killers. You know, there's another band, Mushroom. What are they called?
Grand Funk Railroad.
The Grand Funk Railroad's fantastic.
That was the band.
Oh, yeah, Mark Farner. Yeah.
Mark Farner.
Yeah. There's this, hold on, I want to tell you this band here, and I want to ask you if you know it. Have you heard this band, Leafhound?
No.
Yeah, I hadn't either, and Mark Maron turned me on to it. And they're called Leafhound, and the record's called Growers of Mushrooms. Came out in 71, and Mark Maron turned me on to it about a year ago. Leafhounds, L-E-A-F. And then Hounds Like Dogs, Hound, Leaf Hound. You've got to hear this band. You are going to love them. Growers of Mushrooms. And they are insane. Let's see if I can give you a little taste here. Let's see. Here you go.
I did my share of mushrooms.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
How's that for you?
Yeah, you got the stuff.
Yeah, you're gonna love it.
See that was about that era, you know, like the Blue Cheer.
Yeah, Dickie.
The Grand Funk Railroad. All those of it, they had that, just the blues.
Yeah.
So I mean, I found a record of Blue Cheer, and they were doing like rock and roll covers, like 20 Flight Rock and stuff, you know. And it was like, it's just fucking amazing. I mean, it's rough as bags as a recording. I mean, so it's obviously done somewhere live, you know, but. See, we used to do all that stuff in the early Tats days when we were doing 3 and 4 brackets a night in clubs. So you had to have a lot of material. But when we were jamming, when we were finding, well, who and what is Rose Tattoo, we jammed on the music that we loved, that all of us loved, you know, so we'd all pick songs. So we did 20 Flight Rock and we did Hoochie Coochie Man and we did sort of, you know, bunches of songs. In fact, we used to do a Kraken version of Street Fighting Man.
Wow.
Which, it's on Facefast, it's on live stuff. And I remember George saying when we did all the demos they just said, come in and record everything you play. So it was like 30 or 40 songs. And so we did. And he just loved Street Fighting Man. And he said, well, okay, if we can't find a single because it suited the image of the band so much, he said, we'll put out Street Fighting Man. And so it nearly became our first single. But Rylan's, the original bass player, had this song, Bad Boy.
Oh yeah, I love it.
But it was just a chunka 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 chunka, and we went in one day, and George had chopped it up, shortened it like by half. And said, "Look, this is great." He said, "I'm loving this song." He said, "Now that I've chopped it up, just edited it," he said, "like, come on, Pete, come and put some solo work in it, like punctuate around the vocal." And he said, but it needs something. It's lacking. It needs something. And this is how intuitive George was about everything. And so he said, like, and because the original Rose Tats, which like this lineup, which goes back to the re-release, the re-recording, this re-recording is more like the original recording of the Tats first album before they edited it up. So, you know, like there's some jamming on this album, which we do live, which we did on the original album before that jamming was edited out. And so he just, George just sort of said, go in there and play the song and just sort of here's the new arrangement. And I don't know, it just came out of nowhere. Mick just came out with this dum-dum-ba-da-ba-ba. But it was because of the way that George had edited up the pieces, and he said, you know, we just need something where it was like an accent to get, you know, to come to the end of the passage to go into the next one, right? So, and Mick just instinctively shungat and dat and dat and dat, because it was like gack and 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 gack. It was just that. There was no riff, there was no lick, so to speak. And just came out of the air. Just Mick just started playing the da 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 da, you know. And George just, I mean, like George's modus of operation was he just recorded everything. That was, he always said that, record everything, every jam. That's how Stuck on You came about, was a jam. I mean, why he put it on the album, I'll never know, but, you know, now it's history, so it's got to be there. But see, Sweet Rosetta, which is on the re-record, that was supposed to be where Stuck on You is.
Oh wow! On the first record,
yeah, to be the, you know, the token love song, so
right,
to speak.
Right, right, yeah, yeah.
And I said to George, why didn't Rosetta make the cut? And he said, we're saving it. When we need a ballad single, we'll do Rosetta. And we never got around to doing it. But yeah, so that lick, that signature lick for Bad Boy, that was just came out of Mick just and. Anyway, we walked back into the control room and George said, fuck, that's it. It's now a song. He said, now it's a hit.
Yeah, and it became it.
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
I love Rock and Roll Outlaw, man.
Me too.
What a tune. And Nice Boys, of course, but Rock and Roll Outlaw is just, to me, it's just you. You know, there.
Well, back in the day, we were writing songs, you know, and of course Ian Rylance was still in the band. And again, the extra two tracks, Snow Queen and Sweet Love Rock and Roll, they're both Ian Rylance songs. He started them off, right? I helped with the lyrics, but as Bad Boy was, as Wally. I remember Pete saying, we need a song, and this is before we actually got to record the song. He said, we need a song that sort of says, well, this is what Rose Tattoo is all about. So, you know, like what we are.
An anthem.
Yeah, like, but an identification, like this, we are, and we have become known as, which is even, you know, even though all these years later, the re-release is called Rock and Roll Outlaws. And the slogan for our last year's touring was still Outlaws, because it's a state of mind, you know. And anyway, and the riff for Rock and Roll Outlaws, by that stage, Geordie had replaced Ian Rylance as a bass player. Yeah, it started out as a bass riff, which is, you know, it's a borrow from a blues riff, but he was playing it on the bass, which is why he has it tattooed on his arm these days. He's got all the notes tattooed on the inner part of his arm. Yeah,
that's great.
But yeah, it was the song that we wrote that says this is who we are, this is what we'll always be, you know, because it's not a thing defined by age or whatever. It's an attitude. You know?
It is state of mind, like you said, state of mind. Mm. Mm. I can't thank you enough for doing the show.
No problem.
It's just you're an amazing human. I love I love your vocals. I love your attitude.
Thank you, brother.
Your mind, you got a great mind on you. And I really hope I get to see you one day. And I really thank you for doing the show, because I know what's going on with you right now.
Thank you.
Yeah. And it's, I don't wish that on anybody. And
No.
And I can't thank you enough, man. And I'm really, really hoping to get to see you live. It was just, It was just a complete bummer that this,
well, have a look at the Monsters of Rock cruise site.
Yeah.
And that'll give you the island. If it doesn't go ahead as a cruise.
Yeah.
I'll which come it see doesn't you. Look like it doesn't look like it's going to, but they fully intend to put it on as a festival on an island.
I'll come see you, man. We'll hang out.
Hey. Oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah. It'll be great, man, to see you up there. I love it. Thank you.
And listen, you mentioned your friend from Jet Boy.
Yeah, Billy Rowe. He's a huge, huge Rose.
I met him.
Yeah, you met him.
I am so grateful for what he said. That's a
oh god.
So thank him for me again, please. That was a lovely thing to say. It was
He makes guitars also, rock and roll relics, and his guitars are unbelievable.
Well, it's a wonder Bobby Spencer didn't or crack on him about that because I tell you another thing too about Mark Evans, and he knows more about guitars than I've ever known anyone ever. He's a bass player, but he plays guitar obviously, and very well, but he used to own a music shop for years and years and years, and he sold it out. But he's now the chief advisor buyer particularly of guitars. So he hunts around all around the world. But yeah, I mean, there's Mark. I mean, it's not a well-known fact, but he is what he doesn't know about guitars. It's just fucking, you know, it's not worth knowing. It's like he's an amazing guy, Mark.
That's great. I'm going to talk to him on Thursday, and also,
oh, cool.
Yeah.
You will ask him about that.
I will, and I'll tell you one thing: if you YouTube Dean Del Rey Bon Scott, you can see Billy and I and some friends of mine, Scott Ian from Anthrax and Nikki Six from Motley Crue and Bill Burr, the crew. Yeah, the crew. We do a tribute to Bon, and you can hear some vocals if you're you want to check that out. There's definitely
surely
some Bon meets Angry Anderson in there. And I do the singing. I think you might check out Kicked Thank in you. The Teeth Again.
Yeah. Right, absolutely, bro. Yeah. Now that we put a face to the voice, so to speak. Yeah.
And stay in touch, man. My email is deandelrey@yahoo.com. Hit me up, man, and say
thank you, brother.
And let me know what you're doing. Cause I'd love to talk to you more anytime.
Well, yeah, well, okay. Yeah. I mean, we could get into other areas if you
Let's
like.
I mean, let's do it. Yeah. Let's have you back. I mean, so have them hit me up and I'll have you back again and we'll talk about some more stuff. Your solo records, you know.
Well, yeah, I've got to launch the AA band later on, next year.
Yeah, let's get into that. So have them hit me up and we'll do it.
Appreciate it greatly. Thank you.
I love you, man.
Keep the faith.
And I hope to see you live in February.
All right, it's going to happen.
Thank you, man.
Thank you, brother.
See ya.
Bye.